Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Most of us are content with going about our daily routines, minding our business, keeping our heads down, not getting involved in such things as protest marches or demonstrations. Until something happens in the neighborhood, our community, our country, our world, or we decide we're done with just enduring injustice and going along to get along, and it no longer feels right to stay on the sidelines. What to do? How best to channel those passions? Questions for Farrah Alexander. She's written a book about this, Resistance in the Bluegrass, Empowering the Commonwealth, and it has just been published by the University Press of Kentucky. She joins us from Sellersburg, Indiana. It's about 20 minutes from Louisville. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Farrah.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Farrah, what are some typical forms of resistance or activism?
Well, there's so many ways that you can resist in Kentucky specifically. Over the past 2 years, Kentucky was really thrown into the national spotlight. We saw protests in the street for months at a time every day, demanding justice for Breonna Taylor, for example. And while many argue that justice was denied, we did make progress in many ways and got a lot of attention towards advancing the cause for Black rights, Black liberation, and against police brutality. But you don't necessarily have to protest in the streets. One of the most accessible ways that you can get engaged in our democracy is to simply vote and encourage others to vote and protect voter rights, for example. And in Kentucky, we have many wonderful organizations that you can support that most align with your values. And we're really lucky in Kentucky to have so many wonderful organizers and leaders.
I want to touch on something you just mentioned. Bringing about change is no easy thing. And is it important that anybody that's interested in doing that and becoming active kind of calibrate their expectations and understand that it's going to take a while and a lot of effort?
I think so. And I think, again, going back to demanding justice for Breonna Taylor, I am personally a white woman who has a lot of privilege. And I think a lot of other allies that get involved sometimes expect more progress to happen immediately. Like, they show up and want to speak to the manager of systemic racism, and that's not always going to happen. When we think about promoting change and progress, I think it's more effective to think of it as an evergreen practice. It's not something that we're going to engage in whenever there's an emergency or whenever there's a hot topic on the news. It's almost like housework, raising our kids, things that we have to do all the time. We always have to do laundry. We always have to practice anti-racism. We always have to promote the change that we want to see. And it's just something that we need to approach in the same way that we're going to engage in for the rest of our lives.
In your book, Farrah, you write that as you learn more about Kentuckians' contributions to activism, you found yourself frequently awed by the courage and the vision that they demonstrated. What are some examples of that?
Wow, there's so many examples. I think one of my favorite examples was Ann Braden, who back in the 60s, when housing segregation was a very serious problem and Black families weren't able to purchase homes. And Ann and Carl Braden in Louisville, Kentucky, actually purchased a home for a Black family. And as a result of that, they had tremendous consequences. At one point, the house was bombed, I believe, and they were charged with sedition. Carl Braden went to jail for quite a few years. They had really serious consequences. And when they took that action, they were aware of those consequences and they did it anyway. And I think that kind of courage is just so admirable and amazing to be able to hear these stories and hear from activists who today are still inspired by those stories and, for example, knew Ann Brighton and learned from her personally.
And you have a lot of those stories in the book.
Yes, yes. So many incredible stories from different activists from many different topics. For example, I spoke to a couple who were two of the plaintiffs in the Obergefell marriage equality case at the Supreme Court, and also one of the attorneys involved. That happened right here in Kentucky. Also, of course, Bell Hooks, who unfortunately we lost in the past year. Her incredible work towards feminism, are the work that is ongoing in Kentucky to promote reproductive choice, that is even more topical as of late. And just really incredible stories that I felt very privileged to be able to tell.
In the foreword of the book, Louisville Democrat State Representative Attica Scott talks about reading as an act of resistance. What did she mean by that?
I love that. I know Attica Scott is a very avid reader and enjoys many different books. If you ever see her, whether she's on TikTok or doing a news interview, she has a tremendous bookshelf behind her. And I think that reading is one of the best and most accessible ways that someone can educate themselves on many different issues. And I know that's something that Representative Scott takes personally and does personally. And I think it's just a wonderful opportunity that we all have.
Has social media enabled or complicated activism?
That's a great question, Tom. I personally believe that it has been very positive. It's been positive in the way that groups can organize. They can be a little bit more effective in many ways. Now, with that, of course, that involves complications and possible dangers. So people have to be very careful about the information that they put on social media. For example, maybe when they are participating in a protest or giving personal information, that you have to be careful not to put yourself in any kind of danger.
Going back to that foreword by Representative Scott, she says your book is about building a more representative democracy in Kentucky. Mm-hmm. What would that look like? How would it differ from what we experience today?
Oh, goodness. I think that Attica Scott may agree with me that it would look very different. Attica Scott has done a great job bringing the interest of Louisville, the Black community, women. She has a background in healthcare, and bringing all these interests to the forefront that aren't necessarily. When you look at the Kentucky State House, it is primarily old, wealthy, and white. And I think we just really need to kind of call that out. There are very few people of color in the State House. There are less women than there really should be. And when I spoke to Attica Scott about what people can do, she encouraged them to run for office. She said, you know, I'm just keeping this seat warm for you. She really wants to see more people run for office and kind of demystify that process of running for office, because it's actually a lot more accessible and possible than I think a lot of people may realize.
Democracy is this big, messy thing. And we have a tradition in this country, going back before it even became a country, of resistance, of activism, of pushing back when we don't like something or we think it's wrong. But today, have we become too complacent about things?
That's a great question too, Tom. I think in some ways we have. Unfortunately, I think in many instances, for example, the latest reproductive choice issue, people become a lot more outraged and ready to act when essentially an emergency happens. And at that point, it's in many cases too late. And so I think it's important to realize what your most important issues are to you and stay updated on what is happening with those issues and be very proactive. When a bill is first proposed, for example, in the Kentucky State House that may conflict with an issue that you are very passionate about, then you should immediately push back on that before it is too late.
All right. That's Farah Alexander, whose book Resistance in the Bluegrass, Empowering the Commonwealth has just been published by the University Press of Kentucky. Congratulations on that. And thanks, Farah.
Thank you so much, Tom. It's a pleasure.
Heads up, retail entrepreneurs and makers of Kentucky, a portal to the national and international marketplaces can be found in Lexington. It's the focus of the latest from our partners at the Middle Tech Podcast.
Welcome back to Middle Tech on WEKU. You've got Logan Jones and Evan Knowles here, the co-host of the Middle Tech Podcast. And we just sat down with Jane Mossbacher-Morris, who is the CEO and founder of To The Market. So To The Market is an awesome B Corp company that is going out and making a very turnkey solution so that large corporations and large retailers can work with these smaller, sustainable producers that are in the supply chain and make overall a more sustainable solution and give consumers access to ethically produced and, you know, things like female-founded businesses. And essentially, it's just giving these mid-sized and large retailers access to that supply chain in a very turnkey way through the platform that they've made. So we sat down with Jane and had an awesome conversation about her journey to becoming a founder, all the different things that she saw in the market as she was doing diligence to build To The Market. And it was an awesome conversation just around sustainability and making ethically produced goods for the retail industry.
Yeah. I mean, consumers are beginning to demand this. Media is now starting to put more attention on more ethical supply chains. They're starting to put more attention on those that are doing it wrong. And that's really important because consumers are starting to care more. So storytelling and actually allowing businesses to execute on that mission of being more sustainable is essential. And so this is To The Market platform that Jane and her team have created is really special. And they're seeing success because of how special and the size of problem they're solving. So it's exciting to see that happening, you know, here in Kentucky. They relocated from New York City to Lexington here. So this is really exciting time for sustainability in Kentucky, whether it's App Harvest or now what Jane is doing, Rubicon, who, by the way, Jane is married to Nate Morris, the founder of Rubicon. So there's just so much happening here in Kentucky, and we're blessed to have Jane here building her company.
And one last thing, if you enjoy this conversation, you can find the full episode on the Middle Tech podcast feed by simply searching Middle Tech wherever you listen to podcasts. Thanks for listening. Let's dive on in. Yeah, talking about where your background has gone and what you've gotten to see, it makes so much sense that you identified this problem specifically to kind of go after. And just kind of looking at the market as a whole and the world as a whole and the sustainability movement, it makes a lot of sense the way things have started and where they're shifting and how it's kind of rippling out. You know, you think of organic food, anything you put in your body, obviously that's going to be the one that I feel like would be the most logical starting place.
Totally.
And now as that's moving out with the sustainability movement, you get into retail, you get into what you're buying and what you're wearing every day.
Mm-hmm.
So let's dive in a little bit more to what you guys are actually doing. So you call it being a turnkey supply chain. Is that a good way to describe what you guys are doing? So let's dive into a little bit how you guys are actually going out and sourcing some of those partners that you're then plugging in to existing supply chains for larger companies.
Sure. So To The Market's vision is changing retail manufacturing to empower people and protect the planet. the way that we go about doing that is that we're hyper-focused on making it as easy as possible for brands, for retailers, and for corporations to source and manufacture ethical and sustainable goods. How do we actually do that? We do that by building an incredible vendor matrix of suppliers, everything from, you know, massive factories that are fair trade certified or global organic textile standard certified. So just like the highest certifications around ethical and sustainable footprints, all the way down to artisan groups. We identify them, we vet them through our proprietary vetting system, we generate a vendor scorecard associated with them, and then they're a part of our tech platform, which is then we are able to then go and pitch clients and say, look, we are that turnkey solution for you. We have not only the back end of vendor matrix that is reflective of the types of goods and the types of factories and makers that you want to have be a part of your supply chain, but because of our technology, we're going to be able to work with you in a way that's more transparent than you've ever experienced.
And it's easier for them than to just build it in-house. Is there a level of scale that a company can get to where they can do this themselves? Or are you serving kind of middle market or smaller retailers that don't have the ability to do this? Or are you seeing the whole gambit of the size of companies you work with?
Yeah. So most of our clients are enterprise clients. Mm. So we work with Nordstrom Rack, TJ Maxx, Bloomingdale's, Madewell, Burlington, like big box stores. Tech is always sort of like, could you build it if you want to? I mean, that's always the question, right? You have like the like feedback from the corp dev person where they're like, oh, well, we could build this in-house. And it's like, but you haven't.
Yeah.
And so the question is, do you want to build it and go through all the like subterfuge of trying to build it? Or do you want to buy it or invest in it or use it? I think in our case in particular, I'm super proud of the tech that we've built because it's hyper reflective of actual workflows that exist in our industry. So one of the things that when I was sort of diligencing this space to understand, like, how are we going to play in it? How are we going to be competitive? Like, how is this a venture model? Like, all of those questions you ask yourself when you're thinking about starting a company. One of the things I noticed was that there was just, first of all, total dearth of technology writ large in retail. So it's super common to receive orders in the magnitudes of hundreds of thousands of dollars over email. An Excel spreadsheet, maybe, if you're lucky, you get an Excel. I mean, I can't tell you how many times we still actually have people that will send us Excel spreadsheets that are literally $300,000 orders, $500,000 orders. And it's amazing that there is that volume of work that gets done with these sort of like plug and play, screenshot, Excel spreadsheet, this and that. And one of the things that I remember thinking is like, man, you know, I can order through the Domino's or Papa John's app and literally look on the app and see when the pizza comes out of the oven, when they're like QCing it, and when the driver is like dispatched. And that's like $10. But these are $100,000, $500,000. And it's like over email. Hey, when are we getting? I mean, it's just amazing the lack of technology. And so we've been really, really focused on actually building workflows that are reflective of what the enterprise client wants. Mm. Not what we envision in a perfect world the workflows would look like, but what are the realities of the way that our target clients work and how can we plug ourselves into that so that we're not having to pitch two things. Mm-hmm. We're not having to pitch, hey, we want you to shift your supply chain and the way that you buy and transact, right? That's two big sort of things to bite off. We wanted them to focus on shifting their supply chain. So that means that we have to work within sort of the workflows that work for them.
Yeah. And as you guys are trying to source, you know, ethical manufacturing and add those into the supply chain, give us some insight into, you know, what you guys are looking for. Maybe an example of someone who's doing things the right way and supplying textiles in an ethical way. What does that actually look like?
Yeah. I mean, so it can be broad, like Madewell comes to us and says, hey, we're really excited about introducing more sustainable materials into our accessories. And we say, oh, that's great. We'd love to, you know, be added value there. And here are all the materials that you can play in. You can do jewelry with recycled brass. You can do scarves and hats with recycled cotton or organic cotton. And then it sort of gets developed from there. They might design their own SKUs, products, and then, you know, it runs through to the market system. Sometimes they're asking us to sort of make recommendations based off of things that our factories are already producing. Other times we have clients who come to us and it's their first time sourcing at scale and they have a vision for what they want to create, but they don't necessarily have the resources. And when I say resources, I mean the expertise in identifying makers and vetting them and onboarding them. And that can be big and small. I mean, we've worked with both big and small clients in helping them sort of bring product to life, which is amazing when you help bring product to life and then it ends up in like a Nordstrom, which, you know, we've gotten to do, which is so neat.
How do you quantify? So when a company comes to you and they say, you know, how ethical is this?
Yeah.
How do you quantify those things?
Great question. So we're always chasing progress over perfection. And why I say that is that one of the things that I fundamentally believe is that ethical production and sustainability should be accessible to people of all price points. One of the things that I didn't love about some of the work that I've seen been done previously is that the price point tends to be like super elevated. So it becomes like a luxury good rather than it being, you know, more available to everyone. And then I also wanted to make sure that we weren't taking the approach of being sort of shaming or preachy. Like that is not my spirit. That's not how I show up at all. So I didn't want to be in a place where it was like, unless you're doing it in fair trade production facility and you're in GOTS certified organic, like we're not moving forward. Sometimes it's somebody like a Burlington and you're like, okay, you're in conventional cotton. And so we're going to move you to like the like next better thing, which is called Better Cotton Initiative cotton. Sometimes it's a Bloomingdale's and you can get them to that highest standard of organic cotton. So it's really about moving someone along their journey and being more sustainable and ethical. How do you then quantify that? There are a number of things that we do in-house that allow us to literally provide quantifiable metrics associated with our production process. So somebody like a Fisker Automotive comes to us and says, we want to have 30,000 tote bags. And we say, that's great. We'd love to make them in organic cotton. And we'd like for them to be made in the USA, which Fisker does all of their production in the US, which is so awesome. And we are literally able to give them metrics of how many liters of water were saved, how many carbon emissions were avoided, how many kilowatts of energy were saved, how many fair wages were created, because they went through to the market supply chain versus going through a conventional supply chain using conventional fabric. So it's typically comparing our process to a traditional process. And I say that because there is no such thing as like I create a new consumer good in the world and it somehow reduces like the total carbon footprint, right? Like I can offset it, yes, but production is production, right? Consumerism is consumerism. So it's always about, okay, how can we make it better? How can we help our buyers better understand the difference that they're making by choosing a more sustainable, more ethical pathway through to the market versus conventional factory, conventional material?
So one of the things you mentioned there that you try to avoid is making prices high for the consumer because it's, you know, difficult to source maybe, or the way that they want to brand it might be a luxury. And so they're excluding some members of the market. How close are we to sustainable retail or sustainable items from being close to what maybe more consumerish, mass produced, maybe as a little unethical items are? Like how big is that difference?
Yeah, I think it totally depends on and people ask that all the time, like, what kind of premium am I going to pay? And my answer is, like, it totally depends on how you're producing now, right? We have folks who are producing at really ethical factories but conventional cotton, and so the premium that they might be paying for organic might be minimal. There are folks who are producing in factories that they probably don't feel really good about the ethics on. And so they may be paying like a serious premium, you know, 20-30% premium because they're shifting into a factory that they could put their name on and not be upset if people found out they were doing work there. So it super depends on where they're based. I think what needs to happen collectively and what we're a part of doing and making sustainable and ethical more accessible to people from all walks of life is looking at margin. So we have clients who will try to go out to market and are used to going out to market, making product in China in, you know, I think very challenging factories that want to mark up their good by 85 or 90%. And I think that has to be relooked at because I just don't think that it is sustainable, meaning that it's something that can continue to happen for people to try to represent values associated with their brand. And the values don't have to be like ethical or sustainable. It can be like luxury, fun family, whatever, when you have really crummy things happening in the production of the process. Like, I just don't think the authenticity of the brand will be able to survive if the origin of the good is associated with pain and suffering and difficulty. Like, I just don't see a future where Americans are going to be hyper excited about that. Like, oh my gosh, this is like a dollar and I don't care that it may have been made, you know, by a 13-year-old. Like, I'm just thrilled that it's a dollar. I think the mindset has shifted so significantly. And there is, by the way, of people of all ages and demographics and of all socioeconomic levels. And I say that with confidence because we do service Burlington. We do service TJ Maxx. Those are some of our biggest accounts, TJ Maxx, Nordstrom Rack. People at every socioeconomic level are excited about something that they can feel good about from a values standpoint, from a production standpoint. It's just a function, I think, of us sort of collectively looking at, okay, you are typically looking at an 85% initial markup. Maybe you need to be at a 50% initial markup. And I'm confident that your business can survive because your business will not survive with your current market model because you will lose this next generation of buyers who cannot identify with the way that you produce your goods.
If you enjoyed that conversation, you can find the full interview on the Middle Tech podcast feed on your favorite podcast platform, or you can visit us at middletech.com. For those unfamiliar with Middle Tech, we exist to grow the startup and tech ecosystem in this region through media. We've been around for about 4 years now, talking with some of the top entrepreneurs in this region. For WEKU and Eastern Standard, I'm Logan Jones, co-host and executive producer of the Middle Tech Podcast. Thanks for listening.
A brief follow-up on an issue we've talked about at length on Eastern Standard. The federal government is looking for public feedback on how states should spend money targeted for coal mine cleanup. As Katie Myers with the Ohio Valley Resource reports, a regional grassroots coalition is calling for labor standards and stream cleanup.
The federal infrastructure bill includes $11.3 billion to stabilize and replant abandoned coal mines all over the country, including $75 million per year for Kentucky. Eric Dixon with Ohio River Valley Institute says the guidance prioritizes funding for disadvantaged communities, but advocates want to ensure the projects create good jobs.
The infrastructure law is going to create thousands of construction jobs, cleaning up damage by the coal industry historically. The question is, are they actually going to be jobs that you can sustain a family on here?
A coalition of community groups hope that after the comment period, the administration will prioritize stream cleanup and think about how to enforce the program guidance at the state level. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Katie Myers.
That public comment period closes on June 13th. Comments can be emailed to getinfo@osmre.gov. Need some guidance? Rebecca Shelton and the folks at the Appalachian Citizens Law Center in Whitesburg are willing to help out. Online at aclc.org. Coming up after the break, living with childhood trauma.
I thought that I was crazy.
And where to kayak in central Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
WEKU is supported by Kentucky's Touchtone Energy Cooperatives, who believe that strong communities share strong values. That's why co-ops are proud to support Special Olympics Kentucky for the past 10 years. That's the power of human connections.
WEKU is supported by Hicks and Funson. Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Mitch Whitaker provide legal representation for car and truck accidents and other personal injury matters. More information at 859-777-7000.
Eastern Standard continues with Tom Martin.
Case reports suggest that explicit memory, the type of memory that can be voluntarily recalled from prior experience and articulated, may not be an absolute requirement for post-traumatic stress disorder, that it is possible to experience PTSD from a trauma that you have no conscious memory of. Cheryl Erickson knows this. She has experienced it. She has published an award-winning book about it, Follow Me, Friend, a memoir of undiagnosed PTSD and the healing power of the horse-human relationship. And she's on the line with us from Versailles. Hi, Cheryl. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
And we're going to get to the second half of that title, the part about horses, because that's really intriguing, in just a moment. But first, Cheryl, tell us what happened in your life that you chronicle in this book.
The story is about growing up with symptoms of PTSD from a trauma that I did not consciously remember.
Can you talk about that trauma?
Yes. When I was about the age of 7, I was sexually abused by an adult authority figure in my life. And as is common, you know, with children who are in a high-stress situation like that, I repressed those memories consciously. But because memory isn't necessarily held in the consciousness, it can also be held within the body. I continued to have reactions, PTSD-type reactions from that trauma without remembering what had happened or why that was happening. And so because that was happening and I was having a lot of, you know, anger, a lot of self-doubt, a lot of self-harm, those types of things, a lot of fears that seemed irrational to me, I thought that I was crazy because I didn't have another explanation.
In our correspondence prior to this interview, you've told me that it was quite some time before you finally understood that it was not you, that this was done to you. Tell us about that realization.
Yes, it was not until I was in my early 30s that I began to understand what was going on. And it started actually with another trauma that happened. I had an accident with my horse. And when I fell off of her, that trauma from that fall began to shake loose these memories of this abuse that I had. There was enough of a parallel between the sensations that I experienced after the fall and the sensations that I experienced in that original trauma that it started allowing those memories to come through. And it started as what I call body memories. So it was really sensations that I could feel that I didn't have a conscious memory for, which was a very unusual thing to experience, but actually is not uncommon in the situation that I was in. And as I sought help for what was going on, I began to recover these memories of the abuse, and that is when everything started to make sense.
In an endorsement, the New York Times bestselling author Robin Hutton says your book is a must for anyone who has been abused or knows someone who has been, no matter what form, but especially the abuse that comes from that dim voice inside that says the act was somehow your fault and you'll never amount to anything. Do those words ring true to you?
Absolutely, yes. And so much of what I was experiencing during this time that I didn't understand what was going on was that inner voice. It was an inner monologue that was just very, very hateful towards myself, so much to the point that I actually named it. I gave it its own name because it felt like a separate entity. And that shouldn't be confused with like a multiple personality disorder. That's something very different. Again, this is not an uncommon thing to happen with somebody who has been traumatized, especially as a child, to help make sense of their world and understand their thoughts and what's going on with them. Like you divide your own personality into different little pieces. And this particular piece was very strong and involved a lot of negative self-talk, but also a lot of self-harm back onto myself. So, the biggest thing for me was to keep everything that was happening a secret. So I never turned any of that anger externally towards anything. It was always back in on myself. And I believe it's that voice, which is a common theme through the whole book. You know, like, again, it's her own character, is what Robin is referring to. And that voice that comes from the abuser themselves, you know, a lot of what I repeated to myself and believed about myself were things that he said to me to keep me from telling anybody what was going on.
You had worked pretty hard to hide behaviors that you had assumed meant that you must be mentally ill. You were actually thinking that of yourself?
Yes, I was pretty convinced that that was what was going on and that I was mentally ill or insane, and that I was so terrified, one, of being labeled, especially growing up in the 80s and the 90s. You know, we weren't talking about mental health or PTSD or any of those things then, and anything that had to do with depression or suicidal thoughts, there was just a lot of blame on the sufferer. You know, that was a weakness that they had, or there was something wrong with them, or you had to lock them up in the loony bin, but there was just no support. No, it was very scary to me to be labeled like that. And so I did everything I could to not let that show. So that's where one of those other personalities, just the regular me version, came in. And that was what everybody saw. And that was the normal person that looked happy and quiet and did her job and did her homework and just didn't cause any trouble.
Well, now let's talk about horses and dogs too, for that matter. How do these fine creatures play a role?
For me, so much of how I made sense of the world and how I interacted, I kind of buffered it through my animals, especially through my interactions with horses. I found that horses were something that I understood and something I was comfortable with and something I was good at. And by almost using them to tell my story, sometimes to others, but even to myself, was extremely helpful to me. And as I was growing up, and because the horses were friendly, then I was able to have friends, you know, bring people into my life. They were attracted, at least I believed, to the horse. And so as long as I had that between me, you know, if something got uncomfortable, I could talk about the horse. I didn't have to look at my own life. And that was significant. And I also had a great deal of emotional support from the dogs that I've owned in my life also. And one of the things that happened as I started on this process of healing, and it's the main horse in my story, her name is Farletta, and her role was and continues to be like a mirror to me. When there's something that is in a deep conflict within me, often her behavior towards me will change. And the first time that happened, I was very confused. I didn't understand what was going on. I went from a horse that I had a fantastic relationship with to a horse that didn't seem to want to be around me anymore. It was very nervous and uncomfortable around me. And I didn't understand. And that was actually what prompted me to get some help and figure out what was going on and talk to the therapist that helped me understand some of what was happening and recover those memories. But in order to fix that relationship with Farletta, to help her be comfortable around me again, I actually just told her, I physically out loud told her what I was experiencing. And it allowed me to be honest with myself. But by saying it out loud, it almost shifted that. It was a way of releasing it, which is, you know, part of what I try to do is with telling stories, is releasing those stories so they don't hold power over me. But by telling her what had happened, that shifted that her own behavior. It went back to the way it was before. It's like she was comfortable again. And I've seen that play out over and over again, not only with her, but with other people and horse relationships.
Well, dogs definitely know when something's wrong with their human friends. And so I take it horses also are able to pick up on human emotion. Did you get a sense of actually maybe even empathy?
Yes, definitely. I would say they understand far more than we tend to give them credit for. And part of my understanding of that is animals deal in energy a lot in their communication. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't, even though on the movies, you know, we hear horses whinny and dogs bark all the time, that's not really what happens. A lot of what they do is body language, but also a communication through energy, which we don't necessarily really understand, but they definitely can feel. You know, if I go and try and pretend that everything's fine, and you've got a sensitive horse like Farletta, she's going to notice that, and she's not comfortable with that. And you can see it if you look at wild horses, for example. You know, they're in a herd, they're grazing, there's a mountain lion in the area. They don't all, you know, jump up and whinny at each other and run away. But what you will see is the horse on the outside that's nearest the mountain lion, it's almost like a ripple effect. And it goes across the whole herd without any of them saying anything, and they all start to slowly move away. Mm. And that's been explained as possibly an energy exchange. Mm.
Well, Cheryl, the book is itself a message to survivors of abuse, but if you had to condense that message into a paragraph, and I know that's asking a lot, but what would you say?
I think that the main point for me is it's that you're not alone. And, you know, it's the book that I wish I could have read when I was 20 to realize that the things that I was experiencing may have had an explanation aside from my belief that I was crazy. And to seek help, you know, again, we are in a better stage now where there's not as much stigma around the mental health, but there's still a lot. And to be able to reach out and find help, you know, if there's a teacher, if there's an adult, a pastor, a parent, somebody that you feel comfortable reaching out to and talking to them about what's going on and getting that first step to help. It's not something that you should have to try and deal with on your own. And if there isn't a person that you're comfortable with, then there's, you know, the suicide hotline. You can call that. They've got texting now also, and I believe they've got an online chat. So there's, I guess that's the overarching message, is you're not alone and there's somebody out there that can help you, but you got to take that step to be able to reach out.
And there is this book. Where can your book be found? I found it on Amazon, so there's Amazon. Other places?
Yes, you can get it through my website also, which is www.followmefriendbook.com. And those would be the primary areas to get it.
All right, that's Cheryl Erickson in Versailles, author of Follow Me, Friend, a memoir of undiagnosed PTSD and the healing power of the horse-human relationship. Thank you, Cheryl.
Thank you, Tom.
Aaron Michael from our partner Lex Today is here with another in our summer day trip destination series, talking with Kayak Kentucky's Jerry Sivo James.
Thanks for joining me today, Jerry, and welcome to Eastern Standard. I want to get your opinion, because I know you're the expert on this, on a few good places to canoe and kayak near Lexington. But before we kind of get into those hidden gems, can you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself, what you do, and your experience with paddling?
Yeah, well, I'm glad to be back on Eastern Standard. I was on there a few years ago, and it was a great experience, and I listen to it whenever it comes out. It's a great show, one of the best in the state. Yeah, so like what I do, since I've last talked to Tom, my life has evolved. So I still, as some people know, I run a small social enterprise called Explore Kentucky, which promotes outdoor recreation around the state. And we do a bunch of awesome events like guided hikes, paddling events, and then helping different communities with kind of like figuring out how to use their outdoor recreation assets to bring tourism and also help citizens improve their public health and quality of life. But for the past year, I accepted a job with a national organization called Outdoor Recreation Roundtable, where I work as the Together Outdoors Coalition lead. And the role, my role is to infuse inclusion, diversity and inclusion throughout the recreation economy and across the country. And so I've added that on to my workload, well, you know, kind of explore Kentucky in that role.
Congratulations on your new role. That's awesome. But it does sound like you are the exact person that I need to ask this question to. For someone that's maybe new to paddling, or for someone that, you know, doesn't own their own boat, where's a good place to start around Lexington?
I think it's always good to start to get a feel for it by going to an outfitter, a canoe rental, or a canoe kayak rental place. So there's a few, you know, there's, of course, Lexington Parks and Recreation at Jacobson Park. They rent tandem kayaks, small little lake, which is really cool. Then if you go a little bit out, there is Three Trees Canoe and Kayak in Clark County near Winchester, but it's on the Kentucky River and not far from Lexington. So if you were to drive from, like, I guess the center of Lexington to Three Trees, it's maybe a 20-minute drive, and it's a beautiful, beautiful paddle that you can go on there. And then my neck of the woods near Frankfort, which is not far from Lexington, of course, there's Canoe Kentucky, who rents kayaks and canoes and stuff on the Elkhorn. So there's a few places like that. And then not too far is the Red River Gorge, about 45 minutes from Lex. There is Red River Gorge, Red River Adventure. So I actually worked for them for a summer on the Red River, and they do some cool paddle trips. You can paddle from the Still Bridge near Menifee County, and then paddle down to their shop or their space, or you could do a little paddle to this really cool jumping rock. But yeah, those are a few options. I always tell people, start with going to a livery and experience it for yourself. You know, you rent, and then, you know, before you seek to own.
And could you recommend a spot or two for someone that, say, has purchased their own boat, they've done Jacobson, they've done the Elkhorn, but they're kind of ready to take the next step in, like, a paddling adventure? Do you have anything like that in mind?
Yeah, of course. So, like, I'm always going to promote Fort Boonesboro to Proud Mary as, like, the premier route. It is Pool 9 of the Kentucky River, and it starts at near Fort Boonesboro State Park. And that pool actually is 19 miles and goes to the Valley View Ferry. But a cool little paddle, it's about 6 to 7 miles, is from Fort Boonesboro to Proud Mary. So Proud Mary is a barbecue restaurant on the river. And it's where the Palisades start, a little bit below Boonesboro. And just really great canyon walls, great wildlife sightings. And there's a few restaurants along the way.
For those that might not know, what are the Kentucky Palisades?
The Kentucky River Palisades is a 100-plus-mile canyon system that goes along the Kentucky River. So they start near Fort Boonesboro, and then they end around Frankfort.
They are quite an impressive sight. I have seen them myself.
They're about 100-plus feet in height. And, yeah, there's some caves in them. But don't go scrambling and caving in them, because it's really crumbly limestone.
Oh, yeah. Good tip. And I do have to say, in my opinion, I feel like any citizen anywhere would be hard-pressed to find a paddle that starts at a state park and ends at a barbecue restaurant. That sounds pretty special to me.
Yeah, I think it's one of the greatest routes in the country. And that's, like, why this is, like, a plug. We do an event there, Explore Kentucky. It's our sixth year of this event. It's called the Bluegrass River Run. So it's a paddle sports float, race, and festival that starts at Fort Boonesboro and ends at Proud Mary. So we always do it in May, but due to some logistical issues, we moved it to August 20th this year. And we usually have a couple hundred people that come out and paddle with us, and then we'll have booths and stuff like that that promote the outdoors. And so it's been great. A lot of people, it's some of their first time paddling, and they've done it with us through this event.
That's awesome. Would that be a good event for someone to go to that is interested in getting more into the outdoors?
For sure. Yeah, we have safety boats, like Fish and Wildlife. I have a power boat out there. We usually have the rescue team out there. And then we also have safety paddlers, so experienced paddlers that will paddle with folks. And then we also provide rentals as well. So we've worked with Mike's Hike and Bike out of Richmond. And then we worked with a new company called Get Outside KY and then Blue Moon Canoeing Kayak. And they provide people rentals for everyone. So if you don't have your own boat, you can't BYOB, we got you. And then we also provide a shuttle too.
That sounds amazing. You got shuttles, you don't need your own boat, and you finish at a barbecue restaurant. Sign me up. I'm sold.
And there's music too.
And there's music. Do you have any final safety tips that you want to leave people with as they start to get into the warmer months and start exploring outside?
Yeah, I mean, start off small and like don't, you know, a lot of times with outdoor recreation, people, it's all about like crushing it and, you know, doing the most extreme things and jumping up to do like the most extreme things. And I think just start off small and learn and grow. So like learn technique, go to a course, paddle with other people. And then always wear PFD. You know, it's a big thing that I always promote, personal flotation device. A lot of folks are like, you know, see paddling as like a very gentle sport, but water is really dynamic, you know, things happen. So always wear your PFD. And a big plug for the PFD is wear a comfortable one. A lot of times folks will go to, you know, like a local store, you know, like, and they'll buy like a boating style one that's meant for power boats. So they're big and bulky and comfortable. So invest in a nice paddling PFD, one that's going to keep you safe and keep you like not so warm.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate your insight on this. I'm a recreational paddler, but we appreciate hearing from one of the experts.
I wouldn't say an expert. I'm just, I don't know, just a man.
Expert, advocate, you've been there, and it's been nice to hear from you.
Thank you.
I'm Aaron Michael with The Lex Today for Eastern Standard.
The city of Lexington is about to bring kayaking into its parks and recreation options with plans to buy 30 acres of land along the Kentucky River. As WEKU's Stu Johnson reports, it's expected to be a first when it comes to a city parkland.
I have been working on this project since the first day in the mayor's office, and I'm thrilled it's finally happened.
In fact, Lexington Mayor Linda Gordon calls this announcement one of the most exciting ones in her tenure. The new park near the I-75 bridge will be passive and serve as a spot to put in to kayak and canoe 12 miles between locks on the river. Mary Quinn Raymer is the Visit Lex president. She says a watercraft vendor could set up in the park to offer water safety instruction.
I have no doubt that an education process will be also a part of what is offered out there. But on a smooth day where you don't have much wind, it'll be a really peaceful, easy ride.
Mayor Gordon said an opening date has not been determined yet. She says there's a need for fencing and some cleanup. I'm Stu Johnson in Lexington.
That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. Thanks to Twisted Sister for We're Not Gonna Take It and Tina Turner for Proud Mary. You can find us online at weku.org or esweku.org and on the WEKU app, NPR One, and the Google News app. Want to suggest a topic? Drop us a line at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.